Hello again, everyone who was here before, and hello for the first time to those who weren't here earlier. We record these words, but actually, we don't need to. It's okay to leave no trace of them because they live on in us, whatever we experienced when we heard them. And I'm reminded of that today because this weekend is the anniversary of Thich Nhat Hanh's death last year. And I think we did a retreat the same weekend last year and talked about Thich Nhat Hanh because he had just died. And as he so clearly taught, he's present in this glass of water. He's present right now with us as we speak about him. He's present in the sunlight that beautifully is coming through my window. And in the rain clouds, if it's raining where you are. That was one of his trademarks, Thich Nhat Hanh, was pointing this out to us, that that when we think we've lost someone, and we stay with this, because it's very present for us, this notion of dying and then someone is no longer there. In fact, his experience when he was a young man, when his mother died, at first he wrote in his journals, he wrote that it was the greatest misfortune that he could ever experience, and that anyone could experience, was that their mother should die. And then he had a dream. He was sleeping at night and he had a dream of his mother, who was young and vibrant in the dream. And he spoke with her in the dream with no grief. And there was no hint of the grief and the sadness and the old age and death that had been around his experience of her when she died. And when he woke up, he had this insight that the idea that he had lost his mother was just an idea. And that being and non-being and birth and death were just concepts. And he went outside into the morning, and maybe it was moonlight. So maybe he woke up in the night after his dream and went out, and there was moonlight. And it was so clear to him that his mother was present in that light. And that he realized he could see his mother everywhere, everywhere, all the time. That he had not lost her. That yes, that manifestation of her that he had known for 25 years or however old he was, when, I think he was older than that, but 40 years, say, that manifestation had come to an end. And yet, not really, because that form would just be either cremated and then the ashes would be strewn into the environment, or in fact, probably she was, because they were Buddhist, but if in our culture where we bury the body, it also disintegrates and returns to the earth, and then reappears in many different forms. And so his experience was that his mother was everywhere, in everyone, in every person he met, and in every breath he took, his mother was there. And he would tell people when they would tell him about how they were angry with their parents, with their father, for example. And he would try to help them to see that they were actually a continuation of their father. That if their father died, for example, or his mother died, the parent lives on in you, in your very cells, and biologically, the parent is living on in you. And to be angry with the parents is like to be angry at yourself, almost. And in that sense, he would go on to say that we are actually the continuation of everything. That it's not only our parents that we are a continuation of, but every breath we breathe in, all the other beings, all the other phenomena. Now, this, of course, is the essential view, which is where all, which is what Zen always points to, the essential nature of things, that has no distinctions, no divisions, no separations. In fact, you know, we can say the essential is zero. And yet, it's infinite because it manifests in all these, you know, myriad infinite manners, the essential. But what is the key to the reality is to see the essential. And so when Thich Nhat Hanh is talking about his mother being everywhere, he's talking about the essential nature of his mother. And of the sunlight, the moonlight, of the other people, of the dogs, the flowers, whatever. And that's the essential nature of the universe. And Zen is pointing to that reality. And all koans are approaching whatever the situation you're faced with in the koan. Look at it from the essential point of view. That's what you're encouraged to do, because that's what the koan is pointing at, the essential view. So what does that mean for us? Because we do experience old age, sickness, death, loss. We experience that, and we deeply feel it, as he did, deeply feeling the loss of his mother. Another experience from Thich Nhat Hanh when he was young, when he was a child, actually, and he went on a school trip. I may have told this story before, last year when he died, I don't know. He went on a school trip to visit a sacred mountain. And supposedly there was a hermit who lived on that mountain. This is somewhere in Vietnam. And he was really interested in the fact that it was sacred, this mountain, and that there were, and he wanted to see this hermit. And at some point he wandered off into the forest looking for the hermit. Maybe they all were allowed to do this, I don't know. I don't know the details of the story beyond this, but and when he was wandering in the forest, he came upon a well, you know, a water well. It was extremely deep, and the water was really cool and fresh. And he drank some of it, splashed his face and drank some of the water. And he suddenly felt so fulfilled and so satisfied. His thirst was quenched. It was refreshing. And he felt like he didn't need anything else ever. He didn't even need the hermit. He had found what he was looking for. And this is when he was a child. So clearly he had some sort of spiritual disposition from a very young age, which is not the case for most of us, although maybe it is, and maybe it is for all of us, but it gets clouded over so quickly in our the lives that we are told we should lead and that we are initiated into. Whereas he was living in a culture where maybe there was more encouragement for this looking at the essential and the spiritual. So what a beautiful thing, this child who is fully satisfied with the drink of water and no longer needs to find the hermit. The hermit is that drink of water. The sacred mountain is right where he is standing. There's nothing other than that, something like that. But at the same time, let's come back to what do we do then with our grief? And I was reminded of this recently. I saw a film called Song of Names, which is from a few years ago, probably even 10 years ago, I don't know. At the time, I didn't hear anything about it. But apparently the score won an Oscar, the music won an Oscar, and the actors were nominated for Academy Awards. I missed the film completely at the time. But the Song of Names is survivors of the death camp Treblinka. While they were there, the people in the camp elected a group of elders or a group of leaders to memorize all the names of the people who were going off to their death, who were dying. And then they were supposed to share it with each other so that someone, whoever was left, would know the names of the people who had been killed at the camp. And, you know, there were fewer and fewer of them who when they started remembering it, well, then they would be killed and then others would have to remember it. And in this film, there's a child who was sent to, he was a violin prodigy. So his parents sent him from Warsaw, a Jewish family, just before the war, sent him to London to study with a famous professor and lived with, was housed by a family that was not Jewish, but was very musical, and agreed with the father of this boy to take him in to maintain his Jewish traditions. So agreed that the house would become kosher. They would only eat kosher food. They would take the boy to the synagogue. They would be sure that he got his music studied with this great professor and everything. Well, you can imagine what happens. They don't know what happens to the family officially in Warsaw, but the war breaks out. Germany invades. The Jews are put in the ghetto. They know that many of the Jews were deported to Treblinka. And for some reason, they know that the family was probably deported there. I'm not sure. But in any case, so this boy grows up, doesn't know what happened to his family, and suddenly disappears when he's supposed to have, at the age of 22, he's supposed to have this great concert that this adopted father has organized for him in this music hall. And, you know, it's not the Albert Hall, but it's some great hall in London. And he doesn't show up. And no one knows what happens to him. Just to make the long story short, we find out what happens to him. He fell asleep on the bus going to the concert and got lost, stumbled upon the Jewish quarter in London, meets a guy at there who is from the Warsaw ghetto and survived Treblinka. And the young man asks if he knew his family, and he brings him into the synagogue and they tell him about the Song of Names. And the rabbi, they ask what his family's name was. And so the rabbi, they tell him that the Song of Names actually takes 5 days to sing. And they take 24 hours a day, and they each take turns singing names, and it takes 5 days. So they ask him what his parents' names were, and he says Rappaport. And so they start singing from the part of Rappaport, where Rappaport would be if his family died. And then they come to his parents and his sisters who died in the song. In any case, the whole thing is that the reason I'm telling this is that he then goes on to compose a song that he plays on his violin, goes back to Treblinka, this is in the 50s, goes back to Treblinka, which is just there's nothing yet. There's no monument even moving, and plays the song there. And then himself disappears and goes off, and you find out later what happens to him. But the thing is, he keeps this thing of the song of names is recognizing that these people are still with us, that their presence is still here, not forgetting them. And the rabbi tells the boy that for many of the people in the camps, it wasn't so much their own death that they feared. It was that their entire families would die and there would be no one to remember them and no one to sing the Kaddish for them, because the Kaddish is what is sung when someone has died. And so this was a way of all of them guaranteeing that someone would remember them and then sing Kaddish for them. We do this in our ceremonies when we, just recently, just on Monday night, we did a ceremony for some people who had recently died. We did for Rabbi Singer, who we talked about the other night, maybe last Saturday in the study group, I don't remember. He was a Zen teacher who some of us knew, who died just a few days before. For Chaird, one of our wildflowers who died. Joa knew someone who had recently died, and Lisa too. And so we added their names and we chanted their names and we offered incense. And this has meaning from the essential point of view. It does also from the relative point of view, because we feel something when we do it. We experience the experience, the presence of the person, of those who are no longer manifesting in these forms we know. The musician David Crosby died 2 days ago. Some, I don't know if everybody knows who he is, but from Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, right? For those of us of a certain age, that's the music of our youth, you know, and it's very present. And in all the comments and things that people, I've read a lot about what people are saying after his death, and even people who aren't of a certain age, I mean, even younger people who know his music, everyone talks about how the song is so attached to a memory of a place, a time, a situation, a moment of life, an emotion attached to it. And all of that is living on through his music. David Crosby is living on. He's not dead. I mean, his physical form is dead. He was 81 years old. He was sick. He died. And yet, that music, you know, I listened to some of his songs yesterday. It's as alive now as it was then. And it will be as alive tomorrow. And it's as if, you know, that's the song of names, is his songs, in fact. And when we did the retreat at Auschwitz, some of you, Joa and I did, I don't think anyone else here did it, but has done it, but we chant all the names. We have lists, the records, the camp, the people who created that camp and built it and did the exterminating kept meticulous records of everyone who died. I don't, maybe they didn't do that at Treblinka. I don't know if they did it at Auschwitz. And so there's lists and lists and lists. And then some people have been added to who they didn't record. I'm not sure if they recorded everyone. Maybe they didn't record the gypsies and the homosexuals or something. I don't know. But hey, a lot of the names they recorded. And then people would add names. If they knew that one of their relatives had died there, they would add them on the list. And all day long, for 5 days, we sat there. All day long, we would take turns reading these names, chanting the names. It was the song of names again. As a way to remember, but also as a way to, you know, make alive the presence again. And the presence of, at that place, which, you know, was the greatest of horrors. There's brilliant grass and flowers and trees and all of those. Everyone who has ever been there, everyone who lived and died there, everyone who survived, everyone who participated in the killing, everyone who was killed, it's all present there, all still there. And in me speaking it right now, it's present here too. The beauty and the beast. So it's not only the beast, it's also the absolute beauty of it, of the lives. And when we can connect with this essential nature that is ours, then we can our hearts can open, and then we receive everything as just another aspect of ourselves, maybe something like that, and see ourselves in everything. Like I was saying on the other night, not like everything, but everything is everything. Not being like, but being everything. Thich Nhat Hanh's example of looking at a piece of paper and seeing the cloud is wonderful, because you see the piece of paper and you know that it came from a tree, and then the tree grew from a seed that was able to grow because of the sun and the rain and the soil, and the rain came from the cloud. So the cloud is in the paper, is in this page in front of me that I write on. The cloud is in this glass of water, and the piece of paper is in this glass of water. And Thich Nhat Hanh's mother is in this glass of water. So all of this, just honoring Thich Nhat Hanh again today, because his death a year ago today, or tomorrow, I think it is. And to maybe use that as a reminder to return to the essential point of view. Like when people are stuck on koans, I always say, look at it from the point of view of Mu. Remember Mu. And then come back to that, because that's the essential point of view. And that's who we are. And we can honor that essential point of view, that essential nature, not the point of view, essential nature, by being truly who we are, by fully manifesting just this right here and now. So like in the first morning sitting, I was really tired. I didn't sit very much last night. I don't know why really, but I was really tired. And so I was kind of like, pique du nez, as we say in French. And I knew that I have enough experience now after doing this for 30 years that I used to resist that terribly. I would, fight it off and try to keep my eyes open and become really annoyed. But now I don't fight it. I was a little worried that it would be visible on the screen and that would be bothering people. So the movement, so then the next period I turned so that it would be different, but actually it didn't happen to me in the next period. So because I didn't resist it, and I've learned that that's the trick. Because if we resist it, it's like we're trying to kill it, trying to kill the fatigue and the tiredness. And that's just adding more tiredness. And it's actually not honoring my vow of my precept to not kill. You know? So I honor the sleepiness and I just, okay, let it be. And I know that when I do that, the next period, it was fine. I was still tired, but I was not at all like droopy-eyed, you know, my head nodding off all the time, practically falling over. I was clear-eyed because I didn't resist the droopy eyes. I let them be. And I probably, they were satisfied by that. Those, you know, tiny little 30-second sleep moments. Probably, you know, there were a series of them, but I guess that did it. I allowed it to have its space. And that's the best thing we can do for ourselves and for others. Every moment, in fact, is the song of names, of honoring whatever is here. Honoring everything, like I was saying the other night. Everything is worthy. Every person and every phenomenon is worthy of that song of names. So that's maybe a good point to start the year, at least in terms of our formal practice together here. It's a day. We don't actually have very many days of sitting. In fact, I think we only have this one and March, because February we have a weekend. April, there's the retreat in Portugal. May, there's the retreat in Noisy. And June, again, we have a weekend workshop. So precious days of practice. We may have a surprise Heart of Life practice, retreat in the Heart of Life too at some point, because by maybe back by popular demand, some people have asked me for it. So we'll see. So anything anyone would like to share or questions, comments? Joa?
Yeah, hi. Hello, everyone. It's funny that you mention all this because it resonates very much to what I've been doing for the past 2 days. I've been writing something about lineage chart and ancestors. And I was trying to reflect on what it actually meant that on the lineage chart, it goes back. It goes up again and it goes back. And I was trying to reflect on the meaning of that. And there's several things that came up, but one of which being that the ancestors are our ancestors, but we also become the ancestors of our ancestors by the fact that it goes back. But it also, in a way, it also means they're really, as you're mentioning, like we're really calling them back and it becomes part of us. It really just by reciting the names, we are becoming them or they are becoming me, something like that. So I was wondering if you want to add anything to that, the fact that it goes, the lineage chart goes back. And
I think Catherine has her hand raised.
Yeah, I want to resist that. I don't think we become the ancestors of our ancestors. And I don't know if it's just because I'm on a linear level, I just can't accept that. I do accept everything we've talked about. I've actually read some of the Thich Nhat Hanh things. And so when I look at my palm, I think of my father and I think of all of the heritage, of however many generations of Homo sapiens are there in my palm. But I don't think I become the ancestor of them. So if it's true or if it's debatable, let's give me some more background.
Well, maybe I might ask, so when you hear, when you question this notion of becoming the ancestors, because what, you associate that with like reincarnation or no,
I become the ancestors of the future, but uh-huh. I'm not the ancestor of my great grandmother, if that's right. What you said, Joa.
Well,
maybe I misunderstood.
I don't know, Joa, would you like to say something about that?
No, you didn't misunderstand. It's the question is, what does it mean for our lineage chart that anyone has filled in, if you've done Jukai, that it goes back? And because it's the lineage of our ancestors, and yet, you know, there's our name, then several blank names for the future success, and then it goes back up. So indeed, that, if logically speaking, if you look at it, you are becoming the ancestor of Shakyamuni Buddha, indeed. But I was really reflecting on what does that mean? Yeah. So, I would be very interested to hear what you have to say, Roshi, about it. I gave several things that, you know, on the line of my thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's certainly been a lot written about that, you know, like Dogen writes about it, and there, you know, you come across these explanations of why it looks like that, because also the transmission papers are like that too. It's not just one of the transmission papers is like that. And it's because it's, I guess maybe we could look at it like, it's called the blood lineage chart. So it's actually a red line, and we say when you write the names on the chart, unfortunately I don't have like handy, can't really show it to you, maybe someone has it in handy that they can show. You write the names of all the patriarchs, the ancestors, in this list, and you make sure that the line goes through the name. So the blood runs right through the name. Let's see, everyone is unfolding their charts here. That's an empty one, Joa, you have?
That's the empty one.
Okay, that's the empty one. Someone has got their filled in one. I can still hit the filled in one.
Yeah.
So you can see that it's this line. We save you the agony of having to draw the lines yourself, so we have it pre-printed, the lines. When you receive transmission, you have to do the agony yourself, but we have it printed for you, and you write the names of all the ancestors with the red line running through it, their names, to represent the blood of the lineage. Of course, you know, my biological mother is not my teacher. Right, but the teachings that I received and that I continue to share with all of you came through her, and that's what that represents, that it's coming through each one of those people. The fact that it's a circle, you know, maybe we can see it like that there's no beginning and end to it. It's not like in time, you said the word linear, Catherine. Right, because in linear time, it doesn't work. But this is like the essential has no beginning and end and has no place and time, you know. The essence manifests at any given moment in a certain way. But the essence also manifested before and will manifest after. And that's what I'm just trying to simplify a way that we can understand that this circle represents. Of, you know, it's all one. There's no separation. It's just all one. And if we want to look at it and say we become the ancestors, why not? You know, I mean, that. But if we start taking that to mean literally, then no, of course it doesn't work. It's not. I'm not my child is not my father. My son is not my father. That's true. So when we're talking, we're talking from the essential point of view. We're not talking from the relative point of view. And what Joa says, that's so true, you know, about the chant. We chant that in ceremonies sometimes. We chant the names. We chant the whole lineage. And the whole lineage is always here. You know, this morning I didn't, but sometimes before a Dharma talk, or especially before a ceremony, like before a Jukai, I always, my teacher encouraged me to do this, to invite the ancestors to come and help me, because it's not me who's doing it, and I need their help. And it's a way for me to remember that, because if I start thinking I am this great person doing this wonderful ceremony and this is how I should do it and I'm doing it perfectly, well then the whole ceremony is worthless, because it's just a glass of water and a branch, you know? But it's not just a glass of water and a branch. It's actually much more than that. If the lineage is there and the essential, if I am manifesting the essential nature through that. I see that Lara has her hand up.
Hi. We're talking about the ancestors. A while ago, I read a book of Maizun question. I think the pink and lila one, I don't think I know the name now. And then I thought, when I was reading his book, I thought, oh, I wish I had met him. But then I realized that I already meet him through the practice, and he's the founder of our lineage, and being inspired to practice by his words or by him was sort of meeting him. So I guess we can say I was becoming one with my Zumi through the practice. So I think it's more or less what Joa was trying to say, as I understand. So, what was that?
So?
Only to say that for me, it's not a thing from believing or not believing. It's when I want to believe or not believe, I make an effort to, and I miss the point because I need to do that with my thoughts. I don't know. For me, it's something from feeling it, from I think that Catherine said that she didn't believe in these thoughts, in this speech. And what for me, it's not true, it's that I cannot say that it's for me a belief, because I'm not here in this practice with you. It's not only something from my thoughts, it's something from my heart, something that I feel, that I see like a line. It's not, I don't know if I I'm queer.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Sue. The Zen master Koan Yamada, who is partially in our lineage, we're related because it comes from Yasutani Roshi. He this is a really interesting point. He talks about faith-based practices and religion and experiential practices and religion. And faith-based is based on belief and understanding, whereas experiential is based on practice, experience, and realization. And Zen fits into that second category. It's not concerned at all with belief or understanding. It's concerned with practice, experience, and realization. Catherine has her hand up again.
So first of all, Sue, I do agree. And I think that when I use my head, I get stuck in logic traps. So I think it's about a logic trap. Now, having said that, we're using words, and words I use with a certain logic, and I don't understand why you're saying faith-based is anything other than, I mean, faith to me is a leap of faith. So it's not the words you qualified it with, which is something more, it sounded a little bit more scientific. Experiential is, why is it any different? I don't understand the difference you just made.
Well, so let's say you even use the term leap of faith, right? So, you know, you have to make this leap. You don't know, you haven't experienced it, but you take a chance that it might be, you know, you've never tasted a shot of mezcal, let's say, you know. But you will, you know, mezcal is like tequila, you know, so you've never tasted it. But you will believe what people tell you about it, even though you've never tasted it. And you may have a really good friend who you trust on these matters and tells you it's great, it's fantastic, it's the best thing you can ever taste. And then you might have another friend who you also trust who says, oh no, it's the worst thing I've ever done. I was like so drunk after one shot. It was like, no, you know. Well, you can choose to believe one or the other, but you can truly believe your own experience. When you taste it for yourself, then you know what mezcal is. And then you have your own experience of it. And I'm just picking this like really,
yeah.
You know,
but when I see the Catholics, I live in Versailles and I'm surrounded by very, very practicing Catholics. Mm-hmm. And this is a faith-based religion. And I think, I mean, sure, you've got these doctrines that are very deep, you know, and well-developed and people know them or don't. But I believe what I see is that people are experiencing their religion. That's where it's not... I mean, yeah, they receive some teachings like we are now. I'm not sure it's that different, I guess, is in my head. I don't see that different.
I have no doubt that they're experiencing their religion, but what is it that they're experiencing?
God.
I don't know what that, you know, because I'm not a practicing Catholic, so I don't know that. I do know that the church doctrine is that you have to believe this and that. And if you don't, then, you know, you burn in hell or something like that. I'm really making a gross generalization, but it's the whole thing is based around believing about something outside of yourself that is greater than you and a greater power.
But don't we believe that? I mean, we're just one little thing, and we're talking about being the lineage and being something. We're just a little thing in a universe. It's greater than us.
That's not what I believe. That's not my experience. That may be yours, but that's not my experience. And I don't think that what I when I what I try to share with you from my experience is not that. It's that there is nothing greater than you. That you, my Dharma name is, you are that. Literally, you are it. There's not something greater than you. There's not something better than you. We, and it's everyone. You know, I could say to each little square here, you are that, you are that, you are that, you are that, you are that.
I'm too logical. I don't get it. I still have to work on it.
That's a really interesting realization, though, Catherine, that you see that your mind, like the concept, like Thich Nhat Hanh, this concept of his mother is no longer, his mother died, being and not being. He saw that that was just his just, but it's huge, conceptual thinking mind. And that's a great realization right there, to realize that. What you do with that then, that's what the practice is about. But that's an important realization.
But I get that part.
Good.
That's but great. It's the connection with, I don't want to sort of make it about what my concepts are, but I have a hard time still. I'm not there.
And you're not alone. You know, we all struggle with our concepts. So just to reassure you, and Krisha has her hand up now. Krisha.
Hi, everyone. So I was experiencing during the Dharma talk a kind of anticipation before you continued. So when you talked about Thich Nhat Hanh's mother and dying, I immediately inward thought, yeah, of course she doesn't die, my mother, of course, because she lives in me. And then it came, and that's the problem, because I have issues, or there's a part of me that it's annoyed with some behaviors. And I understand it, that dimension of she living, she's alive, but when she'll die, she will keep, of course, in here. Then I don't know why I remembered my grandmother, that she is dead. And I think, yeah, I prefer to have that dimension of living through wherever. But then it came up, Mu, and the experience I had with you, Roshi, in the Mu, our first koan question, and my answer, and the quality of really come from experience, like my brain was saying something, but I was feeling other stuff, and when I answered from there, it wasn't the same that my brain was saying. And then you talk about Mu. And what I'm thinking, it's okay, it feels like I'm getting something, but I don't really get what does this mean. But about people dying, in this case, parents or mother, but for me, it was really clear that they really don't die. They live through you. And for me, I think this is personal. And when you talk that Thich Nhat Hanh taught people that are annoyed with their parents or have issues, that the issue for me is that part that still lives on me. And it's going on, and the Mu point of view, and you talked about it, and if it's possible, I would like you to speak more a bit more about what do you mean about getting to the Mu point of view experience when you are talking about ancestors and living through.
Well, I think what I said was, you know, that Mu, every koan, Mu in particular, because that's the one everyone starts with, is just, you know, it's a tool that we use to help us experience the essential nature, Buddha nature, oneness, however, whatever term we choose for this same thing we're talking about. So, and I, as I say to you regularly, every koan is just another, is just looking at another aspect of Mu. So wherever, whatever koan you're working on, come back to that. Okay, so what is the essential view here? What's the oneness? Where is the oneness in this? Where what is being addressed here? How is oneness being addressed in this one, this koan? And each person has their own experience. So there's not like there's one fixed answer, as you know, those of you who work on koans. And also, you know, you can read commentaries on the koans and they probably even tell you the answer. But if you don't experience it, you don't see it. You don't know what that is. Again, it's about experiencing the essential nature. So that's when I say go back to the moon, that's what I mean. I always come back to, oh, so where's the oneness in this?
Okay. So I'm thinking, I don't know, perhaps what's bothering me, it's some dimension of separation. And I truly know it's go to Mu point of view, but there's something that keeps me. There's a bothering, I don't know. When I think my mother living through me, it's not necessarily a good thing yet. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
But just yet, it is what it is, but yet I have to see the oneness about it. Okay.
Yeah, you know, we can more easily have the experience that, oh yes, my mother, my cat is living through me, my dead cat, or I see, you know, I see Thich Nhat Hanh in the flowers or something. That's easier than sometimes our mother, because we have, you know, very visceral, emotional relationships, the closest relationships we have. So that's true. That's harder. It's more of a challenge. But the same thing applies.
Thank you.
Debbie, I think I wanted to say something.
Yes, good to see you all. First of all, I wanted to thank Joanne because I had never noticed, I swear, sometimes, I never noticed if that line went back up. I had to get the chart out. I couldn't figure out what you were talking about. It makes it a lot more, I never thought about it. So it's good to learn something new. And I assume that unconsciously I was remembering that this was, we were around the moment of Thich Nhat Hanh's death, but he's been on my mind quite a bit recently with this same koan about both of my parents are deceased, both of them gave me a lot of trouble, and I gave them a lot of trouble during our lifetimes, that not even through me, but in me. And I can, once I've say that, I can recognize a lot of, I've talked to Roshi and other people about the fact that I have to be 2 minutes early at least and exactly on time because my father was a time freak. And he's been dead for a while, and I got out of his world a long time ago, but he was a military man, and I become a soldier about 10 minutes before I'm supposed to open a session or something. Really, it makes me laugh sometimes, sometimes not, so that they're still functioning in me. And my mother is much more of a mystery, but probably maybe does more harm because I don't see what's going on at all times. So I was thinking about this. As a matter of fact, I invited them to sit with me this morning and realize that maybe one of the reasons I was so bent out of shape, I had a very bad traveling experience with a woman, I was going to say friend, but I don't even know if she's a friend, a person that I know. And I think one of the reasons I was so disappointed is because these are the volunteers from Petit Frère, and they had asked me to teach them how to meditate. And I don't think I want to go on doing that or even being part of their group because it's just too painful. So I was thinking, well, okay, I can teach my parents how to meditate. My father had asked me to clue him in because he got nervous on the golf course when there was somebody behind him. He said, they say in golf, apparently in golf tutorials, learn how to meditate so you won't be too aware of what's going, you know, if the people behind you are giving you a pressure feeling, you'll be more zen if you learn how to meditate. So we counted, and my father had zero spiritual whatever, as far as I know, but we counted our breath and everything so that he could be cool on the golf course of all places. But they are in me. They're very actively in me. And so we're going to settle down and meditate together. Except the difference is I'm the boss. This is my house. So thank you very much for all of this. It really hits the spot. It's right where I'm at.
I'd like to add something very important. I feel that is very important that, and maybe Catherine's mind is going to create even more knots in Catherine's mind. But when we say, oh yeah, the ancestors are with me and all that, and I'm with them and all that, we kind of enlarge our understanding of what these people that left were, like as an entity, we enlarge this. And however, we by saying that, we are also trapped in our notion of self, in the sense of we're saying, they're with me, I'm with them, or, you know, they are here with me. And so we're still very much trapped into our little self. So maybe that helps also to kind of unwrap that notion of what the self is, but we need to go even further than that in order to see the oneness. Otherwise it's just, I am with them. By saying I am with them, we're still trapped with the illusion of what the self is, or that there is a self.
Yeah, good point. And even saying they are in me too, is like, so to speak to Lara's thing about meeting my Zumi Roshi, well, I am my Zumi Roshi. She knows my Zumi Roshi. She knows me. It's not my Zumi Roshi's in me, you know, or he's with me. I am him. It's a good point, Joa, because, you know, it really does take, we have to really like unwrap, as you say, like, or décortiquer, or what, you know, take the shell off.
I'm totally confused.
Yep. Well, that's not a bad thing, you know? That's really not a bad thing. I think of, you know, we really have to stop now, but I think of Ananda, who was, you know, the Buddha's cousin and most loyal disciple, knew everything that the Buddha had ever said, could repeat it all, and everybody loved him. He was always there, and he knew everything that Buddha had ever said. But he didn't really get it. And so when the Buddha died, he wasn't invited to participate in the decisions about what was going to happen next. And he was really devastated by this. And kind of like you're saying, well, I'm confused. You know, I know all this stuff. You're not saying you know all this stuff, but I know.
I could.
Right. Of course, we all could. I know it all, and I can say it word for word, backwards and forwards, and yet, what is it? What is it I'm not seeing? No. It's one of the great stories of our lineage. Yeah, Joel?
And this is actually maybe that kind of allows us to calm down on these subjects, is that the first transmission with Makashapa happens in silence. There are no words, no concepts being shared. It just, you know, the guy turns the flower and the other one smiles. You know, they're not talking about concepts and ideas and what is the self, no self, is there it's very simple, just by dropping it, by even not saying I am them, just everything is being dropped. Yeah. So the transmission happens there in just in silence. Yeah.
We have just one thing, José Eduardo, yeah.
Just 1 minute or even less. Because I can add to this, I saw Thich Nhat Hanh, or something mystical, in fact, funeral per accident. I was lingering to the computer and something went on, and I ended up watching his funeral. And it was very interesting because he wrote down, the only thing that was there when he was being cremated was a sheet of paper that he wrote in saying, I am not here. That was his last sentence. So this is only to add even more confusion. But that's what he left. I am not here. So, okay.
Okay, thank you. And on that note, we do have to leave here. And go have lunch or whatever it is that you are going to do now. And we'll be back at 5:30 for those of you, or 4:30 in Portuguese time, for those of you who are planning to return. Bon appétit if you're having lunch. Thank you.